please the court, my name is William Fritchie, 36498. I appear on behalf of the appellant, Christopher Silva. This is a case where I believe the court could rule for either side under existing case law. I'd like to take a few minutes to tell you why I think this court should rule in Mr. Silva's favor. As an overview, factually, Mr. Silva was asked to assist in a rescue, if you will, of a young lady who was having some difficulties in a marriage. The new boyfriend asked Mr. Silva and one other person to go to the home to help get her and property away from a volatile situation. When Mr. Silva and the others arrived, neither the wife nor the husband were there, but the husband's cousin was there. A fight ensued in the garage, and Mr. Silva was convicted of third-degree assault and first-degree burglary, and pursuant to habitual statute, sentenced to 48 years. I would submit to the court that Mr. Silva's trial lawyer was far from competent. I think there's an exhibit on the record that his total bill for ADC was somewhere around $1,700. It was a three-day jury trial. That doesn't leave much room for preparation. And we would submit that he didn't conduct an adequate investigation or preparation, and the district court so found. But there was a hurried last-minute effort where he met with two co-defendants who hadn't gone to trial yet, and their attorneys, and they put together this defense, and I would submit that that is basically all that he did by way of trial preparation. Certainly that's the only part that's substantiated. He testified just to driving by the scene and doing a few other minor things. Would submit that the record is pretty strong that it was a last minute preparation. And in support of that, I would look to the filing of the motions. The record shows that Mr. Haley met with Mr. Silva at the jail on one occasion. I think there's also something in the record there that there was no conversations via mail or telephone. So we're having very minimal contact with the client. And that meeting was right before motions were due. And to get a flavor of it, I would invite the court to look at the motion to set aside prior convictions that groups all of the prior convictions into one motion and addresses none of them individually and just is basically a summary motion for a number of prior convictions. And it shows the type of effort and the lack of work that went into trial preparation. What Mr. Haley, as trial lawyer, didn't do was file a motion to suppress, and he argued at the hearing that he did that intentionally, and I would submit to the court that strategy, or so-called strategy or tactics, which are always belong to the lawyer, are not well-founded if there's a lack of preparation, a lack of research that goes into making those decisions, and I would submit that's what happened here.
The problem here that the theory of defense was not decided upon, according to your position, until the night or two before trial, by which time the inconsistent statement given at the time of the arrest could not be suppressed?
That is my position.
And there was no effort to suppress it?
Correct. Even though Mr. Silva sent a form, here, please file this motion to suppress the counsel, he didn't do it because, in our opinion, he hadn't prepared his defense. And what he came up with was the statement denied, Mr. Silva simply denied being at the scene. But in Mr. Haley's opening statement, he said no less than four times Mr. Silva was at the scene. And he's telling the court that he wanted this statement to come in. And I can't put any logic to that. I would say that the reason for that is because there was a lack of preparation.
Mr. Fritchie, let me ask you, it's my understanding Mr. Haley did not was not the party that introduced the statement, and didn't he state that he expected that the prosecution wouldn't be able to introduce the statement because Mr. Silva did not testify?
I believe, Your Honor, that he said that he anticipated the prosecution trying to get it in, and that he was going to wait for them to put it in, the statement. And by the time that happened, he had already decided this was a big mistake, and therefore he tried to do a last-minute oral motion to suppress. Judge Massaro said, oh no, you're too late on that, but we will visit the Jackson Dental issue. And Mr. Haley presented no evidence on Jackson Dental, and he presented no argument. He just let the prosecution go with the argument, and the statement came in. Now, the court found three instances in which Mr. Haley was deficient. One was the failure to conduct proper investigations. Two was failure to prepare witnesses to testify. And three was failure to conduct proper research. He did not find, the district court did not find Mr. Haley deficient in failing to get the statement suppressed either under a Miranda theory or under a Jackson Dental theory. And to that argument, I would submit that the trial court misapplied the law significantly. Judge Dicer ruled that the statement could have been used to impeach co-defendants. There's case law cited in the brief saying that's not the case. And the trial court also found that he couldn't find that a statement would be involuntary if it was exculpatory, and there's case law contrary to that. So I would submit, in addition to the failure to conduct proper research, failure to prepare witnesses, and failure to conduct proper research, this motion should have been a significant grounds by the district court for finding ineffective assistance.
In the dispute about what, I mean, isn't the motion sort of premised on the fact that the defendant, Mr. Silva, alleges the officers pulled guns on them when they got out of the car, and his statement was made either with a gun pointing at him or to an officer who had pointed a gun at him, and that he was therefore in custody and was required a Miranda warning? Isn't that the basis? And there's a dispute about whether the gun was ever drawn.
Yes. This was a felony stop where the police denied drawing weapons. We presented the two co-defendants and the wife at the hearing. They all testified there were guns. They also testified to that effect during the trial, but it was on cross-examination. It wasn't evidence presented by Mr. Haley in an effort to suppress these statements. By the time Mr. Haley got to his final argument, I mean, he's talking about how his own witnesses are liars, and he's saying that lying is not a material element of the charge of burglary. The final argument shows clearly how misinformed Mr. Haley was going into this trial. We're under the old burglary statute when this trial took place, and that statute, they had to show that he knew, as a matter of scienter, that he was entering unlawfully at the time he entered, not that it could be withdrawn after he entered. This wasn't argued. And I would submit to the court that the trial court, even though he found three grounds of deficiency, and as I would submit, missed on fourth, ruled against Mr. Silva on the basis that there was no prejudice. And the prejudice, first of all, I think even though finding a deficiency in trial counsel can be a difficult burden, prejudice shouldn't be. It's that something is, that there's a reasonable likelihood, a reasonable probability. That's a standard less than by preponderance of the evidence. And it's difficult here because the two co-defendants get plea bargains by the prosecution coming in after Mr. Silva's trial, convincing the judge that it was no burglary. And the trial court is bothered by that, and I believe those transcripts are part of the record. Well, how can you convict Mr. Silva of burglary and you come back in here and tell me there's no burglary? I would submit to court that there was no burglary. that he got caught up in that on this, on the basis of the consent argument. Judge Dyster, the trial judge, he's the judge that ruled on the 35C, he said that he couldn't find prejudice because he couldn't find that the result was not just. And he seemed to be preoccupied with this consent issue and under Ager, whether there was any way somebody could defend this case. And I would submit, under the old case law, and I cited the Oral case and a few others, the issue was cyanide. And this is a common problem anymore when you have domestic situations, you have divorces, many of which start with a fight or an assault or something, and there's a protection order, and the husband the other spouse is being asked to move out, and he says, "Hey, Joe, can you help me get my furniture?" Little does that person know that he's not supposed to be on that property. That was the case with Mr. Silva.
Mr. Fritsche, can you explain to me how then, if the jury received instructions on consent, given that that may not have been the law at that time, and what you're now stating, that the jury should have heard the knowing element, how would that have been different in the jury's evaluation of the evidence?
The jury would have evaluated it from a subjective point of view of Mr. Silva, and that is, did he know that he was entering unlawfully? And the answer is no. They have the proof that he knowingly, unlawfully, in a combination, entered the property. And I don't believe that they could have proven that.
That's because they've been invited over by...
They've been invited over by the wife, but that's where he got hung up on the consent issue, there being some interpretation that the husband's cousin could revoke that consent, or upon an assault that consent was automatically revoked. And I would submit that that's not the case in these facts under the law in effect at the time. I would like to reserve a few minutes, but I would certainly answer any more questions if you have.
Certainly may do.
Thank you. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Melissa Allen, and I represent the people in this case. Rather than starting with what happened at the second ineffective assistance of trial counsel hearing, I'd like to take a step back and consider that after this case was remanded from the Colorado Supreme Court, counsel here, Mr. Fritsche, was appointed to assist Mr. Silva with his ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel claim as to Mr. McNulty. And he filed a supplemental petition and brief that alleged not just ineffective assistance of Mr. McNulty and how he handled that motion, but also alleging a conflict of interest between McNulty and Mr. Eisner, who was originally on the case but then was removed soon thereafter and had nothing to do with the trial portion of the case. So the trial court ruled orally. Mr. Fritsche then supplemented with his motion. And the trial court orally ruled in September of 2008 that the defendant had timely raised the conflict issue, so he didn't have to show justifiable excuse or excusable neglect for late filing. Then in October, also in an oral ruling, not after any testimony had been taken, the court found that Mr. McNulty labored under an actual conflict because of his relationship with Mr. Eisner. And then after that, the court took testimony allowing Mr. Fritsche to open this back into ineffective assistance of trial counsel, even though that had already been litigated and upheld by a panel of this court back in 1999. And it's our position.
But if there was ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel, isn't the best way to demonstrate that to demonstrate that he didn't raise or didn't adequately argue ineffective assistance of trial counsel? These things have a tendency to stack. And so if he can raise issues about ineffective assistance of trial counsel, he needs to do so in order to be effective because the prior post-conviction counsel didn't or didn't do it effectively.
But that's putting the cart before the horse, Your Honor. In order to demonstrate ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel, he should have been focusing on what post-conviction counsel did or didn't do. And that is not at all what this was about. This completely reverted to everything to do with Mr. Haley and the trial and nothing to do with Mr. McNulty.
That was the problem I tried to solve in Hickey unsuccessfully. And that is continually going back and revisiting what happened at trial.
Right. And I think in this situation, we had a motion hearing on the ineffective assistance of trial counsel.
Ineffective post-conviction counsel. Or an ineffective or a post-conviction counsel who had a conflict.
A conflict.
Or
and
both.
That's interesting, yes. By supposedly, I'm asserting that there was no ineffectiveness of McNulty shown anywhere, and there hasn't been.
Well, do you have a duty to cross-appeal then? Or is that just a finding of the court that you're stuck with if you didn't cross-appeal?
No, I don't think. I think maybe under some circumstances there are situations where we would have a duty to cross-appeal, but not here, because all of these rulings stemmed from this one 35C motion, if you're following me. The supplemental that Mr. Fritchie filed, the court's oral rulings, and then his, you know, four-day hearing on ineffective assistance of trial counsel, which apparently was longer than the trial itself, all of those stemmed from that one motion, and there was no final appealable order until everything was done. So I don't believe that could have been appealed at that point. But getting back to the conflict, because I think this is a really interesting issue. My fingers are sticky. We know what was raised in the original ineffective assistance of trial counsel motion and hearing. And we know what was raised in the second one, which was the more recent hearing in 2009. So the argument goes that there was this conflict between McNulty and Eisner because of some information that Eisner had passed along to the prosecution, which made him ineffective.
And then, weren't they both public defenders?
Yes. And then there was this conflict because they were both public defenders. But we've never heard anything about any of this alleged ineffectiveness of Eisner that supposedly caused the conflict in the first place. Maybe you're not following me.
No, I'm following you perfectly. My problem is, assuming for purposes of argument only, that the original post-conviction counsel was ineffective for not raising these issues. This is the way they're raised.
But they weren't raised. That's the point.
Now, they weren't raised, and that's the problem with post-conviction counsel, or arguably so.
No, but I mean they weren't raised the second time around. There was nothing ever raised with respect to Mr. Eisner.
You're saying in the current motion.
Yes. So, I mean, where's this conflict? If this conflict was so big that it caused the court to find that McNulty could not adequately represent.
I thought the problem was trial counsel. You're saying there are no allegations in this motion alleging ineffective assistance of trial counsel?
Oh, no. I'm saying that this was remanded to deal with ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel, and that somehow it has completely reverted to a second full-blown hearing, argument, and everything else on ineffective assistance of trial counsel, which we've already done and has already been shown.
Read my remand in Hickey. I mean, that's what I was trying to avoid in Hickey, and it never happened. It continues to roll on top of each other every time.
Yes, Alan, let me ask you this. Okay, so we have one ineffective assistance of counsel hearing where it was litigated against trial counsel. There was an appeal of that, and that was affirmed.
Yes, an unpublished opinion in 2003.
Okay. Then there were subsequent proceedings that had happened both in the trial court and the appellate court. And in the appellate court, which went all the way up to the Supreme Court, it was determined that Mr. McNulty, who did that original 35C proceeding, where he alleged only ineffective assistance against trial counsel, that Mr. McNulty could be found to be ineffective both on failure to call witnesses with regard to trial counsel's ineffectiveness, and could be found ineffective with regard to having a conflict of interest.
Yes.
So on the two points. So then when it was remanded, the remand was for both the trial court to determine whether the motion was justifiably excused for its late filing as to both the conflict of interest claim and the ineffective assistance of litigating trial counsel's ineffectiveness.
Correct. But my recollection of the court's ruling in that regard was that it didn't even deal with whether Mr. McNulty was ineffective in the way he handled ineffective assistance of trial counsel. The trial court issued a ruling, just kind of a blanket ruling, that there was this conflict between McNulty and Eisner such that apparently it ruined all of his representation with respect to Eisner and then trial counsel, although there was never any further, there were no conclusions or anything with respect to that. It just went straight to, okay, so now let's just open up this whole ineffective assistance of trial counsel again. Really, the only thing that was ever determined, and that wasn't, in my opinion, determined properly, was that there was this conflict between McNulty and Eisner such that it affected Mr. McNulty's representation. I feel like I'm beating a dead horse here, but I think what I keep coming back to is, if there was this conflict because he didn't present anything with respect to Mr. Eisner because of their relationship, We should have seen something this time around about Mr. Eisner and what happened there with respect to giving this confidential information to the DA.
Well, let me ask you one question then. All right. So if Mr. McNulty was found to have a conflict of interest because of the situation with Mr. Eisner, then were the proceedings which Mr. McNulty was the attorney, were those valid proceedings?
I think they were, because they had nothing to do with Mr. Eisner. They only had to do with trial counsel. I don't think that you, I think your conflict, if you're going to find a conflict, there actually has to be a conflict there. And I think in retrospect, we can see that there really was never a conflict between Mr. McNulty and Mr. Eisner, because nothing has ever been raised with respect to Mr. Eisner's ineffectiveness.
Yes, I hear what you're saying, and I think that the concern of the conflict was that Mr. McNulty avoided litigating anything against Mr. Eisner because of the conflict.
And I think that's true, which is why then a new attorney was appointed who could then litigate whatever ineffective claim there was against Mr. Eisner. And lo and behold, there is no allegation of anything that Mr. Eisner did that was ineffective.
Was ineffective assistance of trial counsel litigated in the first appeal, first 35C?
Yes.
Of trial counsel?
Yes.
Litigated again here?
Yes.
Different issues?
Some. I
noticed in your brief that you don't address the merits.
Not. I was too tired.
I don't. I don't want to take that as a waiver.
No, I...
So what do you have to say about the merits?
Well, I did address, just in my defense, I did address a few of the bigger ones that had to do with suppression of the statement and the involuntariness of the statement. Let's see. My argument, although brief, was, you know, some of these arguments had to do with he would have testified but for the fact that his attorney didn't move to suppress the statement. And I think the record at the hearing is clear that he made it clear to Mr. Haley, sorry, the defendant made it clear to Mr. Haley that there was no way he was taking the stand because he has 6 prior felonies. And I think, you know, it's important, we're talking about Trujillo and Medina as far as a couple of these defendant's voluntary unwarned custodial statements can only be used to impeach the defendant if he testifies at trial. That's the Trujillo case. And the rule that the prosecution cannot admit involuntary statements into evidence regardless of a defendant's custodial situation, whether or not the statement was inculpatory, and that's Medina. Now, the argument here is that the trial court erred by not knowing this law, but also in conjunction with that, that Mr. Haley was in error for not knowing this. And both of these cases came out after this case was tried. Trujillo is a 2002 case, and Medina is a 2001 case. And I still, you know, I think there is enough in the record, and this court may not agree with it, but that's not the standard. There's enough in the record to uphold the trial court's ruling that the defense attorney made a strategic decision to not suppress this statement.
The trial court, as I recall, said there was no prejudice. Trial court found deficiencies, 3 of them,
yes,
as I recall. Didn't talk about the motion to suppress. But each case found no prejudice. That's basically what the trial court did. Am I correct?
Yes. After looking at everything, taking everything into consideration. And, you know, I understand the concept of an ill-conceived defense, but there are some situations where you really just don't have much of a defense. And I understand that Mr. Fritchie sees this as a domestic dispute. I mean, I think that the other side of the coin is that there were witnesses, the victim who was beat up, who testified that it was the defendant who did it, and that, you know, he had no, he was not invited onto his property. And I see I'm...
Whose property was it? Victim's property?
It was not his property, it was his cousin's property. And I see I'm out of time unless the court has any other questions. I'd ask that, albeit on different grounds, this court uphold the trial court's order. Thank you.
Police court, I labored a little bit with counsel's brief because I didn't know if I didn't understand the issue or whether I was missing something, whether she was missing something. And as I sit here today, I think she was missing something. This was my first 35C ever. It's this multi-level that the court's talked about. We got post-conviction counsel. Well, clearly the remedy, if you succeed against post-conviction counsel, is a new hearing against trial counsel. Otherwise, you have no remedy. You can go in and say, okay, there was a conflict of interest, or Mr. McNulty was ineffective, but that can't be the end. There's got to be a remedy, and the remedy is, and I think that came out of this court's first opinion on the Silva case, is that if you find a conflict, it needs to get a new hearing, and that's what we did. I asked for a pretrial, I'd get a letter from Fort Collins to Grand Junction on that very issue. Judge, do you expect me to come over here prepared to do this A to Z, or are we going to address Mr. McNulty, and then if I prevail there, come back against Mr. Haley? And that was the decision. We're going to bifurcate this. We had a full-day hearing on this conflict issue. There's a 4-page written decision where Judge Dyster found a conflict of interest and justifiable excuse, although he didn't make an oral ruling on that in the middle of the hearing. So I would submit that we did litigate that issue, and then what we were left with was a remedy to come back against trial counsel because the court found indeed there was a conflict of interest involving Mr. McNulty, and those issues were heard. There is a transcript on that as a part of this record. And I would submit that anytime you have an activity by a conflicted counsel, that activity is void. It can't be held against the party who suffered as a result of a conflict of interest. I would agree that this decision was not favorable to both sides. Part of it was favorable to the government, part of it was favorable to Mr. Silva. I would submit under those facts, there should have been a cross appeal on that issue, on whether or not the court was correct on its ruling, finding a conflict of interest in that first full day hearing. It would seem to me that that's certainly not anything that I'm going to appeal on behalf of Mr. Silva. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We thank both counsel for their argument and briefs. The case is being submitted. The written opinion will issue in course.